Welcome to Beyond Beauty, where we uncover the remarkable stories behind the extraordinary women artists in the world of art and culture. I'm Jacqueline Cofield, your host. Join us as we explore the diverse landscapes of artistic expression, shining a light on the voices that often go unheard and the perspectives that redefine beauty and knowledge. From Nigeria to Brazil, from India to Jamaica, we celebrate the rich tapestry of creativity that transcends borders and challenges conventions. Through insightful conversations and captivating narratives, we invite you to immerse yourself in the stories of courageous women who dare to dream, create, and inspire. Today, we're privileged to delve into the captivating journey of Mine Atairu, a doctoral candidate in the Arts Education Program at Teachers College, Columbia University. So today, we're going to be talking with one of my classmates who I met at Teachers College, Columbia University. She is also a doctoral candidate in the Arts Education Program. And her research is amazing. We're going to talk about that today. Her name is Mine Atairu, and I'm so excited to speak with her today. Mine, we've studied together as doctoral students at Teachers College, and I'm just curious about your path. Can you talk about what brought you to pursue your doctorate and also what brought you to your current research?
First of all, I have to say thank you, Jacqueline, for inviting me to your podcast. About my journey. So I have a master's degree in museum studies. And after I obtained my master's degree, I worked at some museums in Washington, D.C., because I graduated from the George Washington University. But after a while, I think I just got tired of working in museums and I wanted to do something that I felt was much more impactful. At the time, I believed that obtaining a doctoral degree would help me towards that path. So I decided to apply to Teachers College and I got in. That's why I'm here.
Yay. I mean, it's a great place to be, you know, being in New York, being able to study in New York City and all the arts that's available to us here is just really a blessing. Do you think that your schooling experiences as a young person, like K-12, your elementary and middle school and maybe high school experiences influenced your proclivity for the arts and, you know, the fact that you're an artist now?
Yes. I have always, at least my siblings tell me, I've always been the artist at home. I would make this like teeny tiny cameras. And when people visit our home, I would like imagine I'm taking a photo of them and then draw the image of them and give it to them as they leave the home. But I was also very much from high school through like undergrad, I was an art student. And so in Nigeria, you're able to like skip the science classes and just like take art classes. So in high school, I took more art classes. I've never taken a class in physics or chemistry before because of that. And I have an undergraduate degree in the creative arts. So it was a mix of like studio art and a lot of like art history, Nigerian art history to be specific.
Amazing. So Nigerian studio art history.
Not Nigerian studio art history. One was like studio art, which is like practice based.
Right.
And then we have art history that was much more geared towards like Nigerian art.
Oh, Nigerian art history. Mm-hmm. Amazing. So yes, you're taking us back to your roots. Can you tell us about where you grew up and sort of how your educational journey has led you to where we are today?
Yes, I grew up in Nigeria. I am from a small state known as Edo State. If you're aware of like the Benin bronzes, they're really at the heart of repatriation conversations in museums today. They're like a collection of 3,000 objects that were stolen from Nigeria in 1897. Later, they were shipped to England and then distributed across a range of museums and private collectors. So that's where I come from. And much of my research as an artist is focused on the Benin bronzes and thinking through questions of repatriation and what happens post-repatriation.
Oh, so did your research on the Benin bronzes naturally lead you to AI work? What made you choose this instead of other mediums?
That's an interesting question. So when I came to Teachers College, I was very interested in artificial intelligence. So it started off with my research in AI. as a medium for making art. But during the pandemic happened and I started reading more about Benin's history, that's when I decided I wanted to explore like the intersection of like art and my history. But at the time, I also didn't have access to like physical like art materials that we would have because it was lockdown, right? And we were all home. So that was the one medium I felt was easy for me to work with.
Okay. So uncovering forgotten history brings up a range of emotions. This research that you've been doing, in my research of your work, I read about how you, looking at the 17-year artistic period where there was artistic absence during the interregnum in Nigeria, can you explain a little bit about that history?
Okay. So I have an ongoing project titled Igun. And what I try to do with this project, or what I attempt to do with this project, is to think through questions about objects that could have been made during a 17-year artistic absence, artistic decline, but then backtrack to like the history of Benin bronzes before you even get to my project. And as I mentioned earlier, so Benin bronzes are this collection of 3,000 cultural objects that were commissioned by the King of Benin prior to British colonization in Nigeria. So once the British colonized Benin Kingdom, they stole those objects from us, burned the city, shipped them off to England, sold the objects in England to offset the cost of invading Benin Kingdom. Today, at least 160 museums worldwide have at least one Benin bronze. So I was very interested in what happened after that invasion, particularly to artistic production in the kingdom for two reasons, right? Before colonization, art making in Benin Kingdom was sort of defined by the monarchy, by the king. So the king, I like to say, was the sole commissioner of the arts. You could not, as an artist, make an artwork without his permission. So especially with materials that were imported or that were rare in Benin Kingdom. And so one item, for example, was bronze. Bronze was an imported item from Portugal. And so the king would store it in his house, in his storage, wherever that facility was. And so when he would commission the works, he would offer the bronze material to the artist. So if you're an everyday person like me and you're not from a royal family, you couldn't have a bronze item because it was basically stored by the king. And so I was interested during the interregnum era just refers to a period where there's no king in the kingdom, right? So what happens after the king was deposed and exiled from Benin by British colonial actors, right? What would you have done as an artist who grew up working with this hereditary guild system that was very much based on permissions from the king who would like sanction the production of making art? And that was the question that led to that project. So I looked through archives and I couldn't find any object that was made during that period, at least that 17-year period when there was no king. So I decided, okay, what could these objects look like? And I was thinking through this question from the perspective of critical fabulation. I know you're very familiar with Sadia Hartman's work.
Yes.
Like, right? So I'm very interested in imagining what could have been. I have these series of like subjunctive questions. What could have been made? What material could artists have explored? What objects could these forms have looked like? Not because I'm trying to present objects that we know that they absolutely could have been made at that time, but let's all imagine possibilities and perhaps draw attention to that 17-year period.
Wow. Okay. So I'm really loving this speculative nature of your work. I read that your depictions of objects stolen from the Kingdom of Benin are not meant to be replications or replacements. Is that part of why you choose AI rather than sculpture, for example, to distinguish?
Not exactly. Like, I want to say that it's more cultural reasons than it is about the medium I'm working with. So the Benin bronzes are objects that serve religious purposes, cultural purposes. They're used for ceremonies. They're used for rituals. They're used to commemorate past king. And so like the production process of a Benin bronze, traditionally speaking, the king would engage in that process, right? There are these performative, ritualistic acts that are necessary to like legitimize, to give legitimacy to this object. within the cultural corpus. And so the king would have some rights with the bronze caster prior to production. During the production process, also there are some rituals that have to be carried out post-production as well. All these are necessary to sort of activate these objects. It activates its relevance within the corpus, right? And so my objects are not necessarily serving that functional purpose in a way. And it would be disrespectful to my people for me to say, oh, I created a series of objects and I think it commemorates a king from the 16th century, but it doesn't, right?
Wow. One of the things I love about art, I mean, you just learn talking with artists. You guys are historians. You guys are deep intellectuals and researchers. Like, I don't think I've really spoken to any artist who's not a serious researcher, who has not like proactively sought out to understand from like multiplicities of perspectives and also sociocultural like backgrounds and things like that. So this is incredible. I read that until the last few years, you didn't feel confident to show your art. Your Instagram begins with an AI series of portraits focusing on distorted features that amplify the beauty of Blackness. How did these pieces help your confidence and how do you define that style?
That's a good question. I think I get that question a lot. Like, I've always been the art student and in my family, within my family, even before I started like practicing as an artist, they've always called me an artist, but I never had like a public facing practice. It was always like behind closed doors. I was making pieces for family and friends. So it was during the pandemic. I feel like we all connected to our creative geniuses during the pandemic. We all took like craft and making art and performance. And for me, this was it. So I started posting on Instagram, but it was primarily to a community of folks who were much more familiar with the AI space. And so I think that validation, the technical validation that came from posting those images is what started allowing me embrace my artistic identity. I don't necessarily think they understood the conceptual underpinnings, but it was more, okay, you're working with this technique and we appreciate it. And I think that started it off for me.
Wow, I can totally relate to that because I also started on Instagram when I started my doctoral journey. I thought it was going to be part of my method. So I was sort of experimenting and I wanted to document my doctoral journey. And over the years, I mean, now it's 4 years. And so I have 4 years of this content of me as a doctoral student. And it's pretty powerful now. It does give a lot of confidence. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's like something, maybe there's an article in there. That's something somebody's not talking about, the role that social media yes. is playing in cultivating creativity, mm-hmm. particularly during the pandemic. Fascinating. Okay. So I want to talk to you about self-care. So you are very busy. You've got a lot of things going on. You're winning awards, traveling around. I've been following you on Instagram. So you're in the studio and long hours, seems like sometimes late at night, early, all over town, different studios. So how do you recharge yourself as a creative? How do you replenish your inspiration? What activities do you enjoy to do?
I was reading an article yesterday. I mean, I've been reading this article like almost every day because I'm so stressed out. It's an article by Bell Hooks about creativity. And she talks about being undisturbed, like undisturbed, uninterrupted time. Just like these moments of like lingering and wearing silks and satin and expensive scented candles, just like wasting time, right? Not doing anything. That's how I recharge. Quite literally, trying not to do or think of anything.
I can feel that. I feel like when you say that, just there's like a bunch of memes that come to mind. Mm-hmm. Like funny memes. I feel like some that I've already seen on that same topic. And even now, there really is a movement to focus on rest. And at the MoMA Museum, there's a resting room. So in regards to your project, Igun, I read that it touches on these topics of reparations. Can you talk about that?
I want to say, I mean, as an artist, when you produce work or you create work, people always translate it differently. And I think Igu means a lot of things to different people, depending on who you are in relation to like colonialism and where you're located in the world. right? For me, it primarily serves as, you know, proposing objects that could have been created during this 17-year period. And I think for institutions, sometimes it sparks conversations about reparations because they own these objects and they're thinking of better ways to, you know, work with artists from Benin Kingdom after they repatriate the objects. And so it really depends on your position. I don't necessarily think about my work. I guess I don't necessarily think about reparations when I'm making my work. That's not the purpose. It's more research, and that's what my work serves.
Okay, I get that. So when people are encountering the work, some for them, mm-hmm. depending on where they're, what they're thinking about and their experiences and their awareness, they might be thinking about reparations. I mean, that makes sense because it is something to think about, you know, what to do with the situation. You have stolen goods,
right,
you know?
Right.
So let's talk about your ideation process, your creativity process. Let's say you're getting ready to start a new project. Like, how does that happen? Do you create a plan? Do you experiment with mediums? How do you, you're a multidisciplinary artist. So how do you choose which direction to go?
It always starts for me with a question. Most of my projects are led by questions. I have curiosities I have rather than, you know, trying to give life to a form. If I read something and I encounter something, I try to answer it by employing a medium. And so it starts from there for me. I don't necessarily always have like a set plan, except I'm working on a commission or a residency. Most of my projects are very much open-ended and they're ever evolving in nature.
This topic of the repatriation of the Benin bronzes is, it can be a very heavy topic. And I'm just wondering about what are your emotions and feelings around this project and that history?
That's a good question. I think my people have been asking for this works for the past century. They were stolen in 1897. And it's a difficult conversation to have sometimes, especially because I live in the diaspora and I work with museums. And so there's the question of how do you, as an artist, sometimes advocate for the little things I can do, right? When I meet curators for change in a way that I know I, like my drops of water, I'm making an impact on the bigger picture. But I'm also very much aware that, because I think folks sometimes, when conversations around pre-colonial objects are important, it's always related to the king, right? I'm not from the royal family. I have no royal ties. And so I'm distant from the Benin bronzes in that sense that these objects are not objects that my ancestors have, right? In fact, my ancestors were expelled from Benin in the 16th century by the king because, right, we were dissenting voices and we declined offering his yearly tax. So instead, he said we had to leave the center of Benin. And so I'm currently doing research on Benin and urban planning. So at the center of Benin, you have people who the king cared about and people who paid attention and who were most like respectful to him. And at the fringes of the city are dissenting voices, rebels, immigrants, the poor people, people he didn't want to see. And so my people live at the further edge of Benin. And that's why our religion, we practice Benin's traditional religion. We're also Muslims, we're Christians, like we practice multiplicity of religions. And so I'm very aware of my distance from the royal family and the Benin bronzes, but also understand that it's important to my people and who we are in the world and how we define ourselves, how the West sees us. And that's really important.
Okay. How has creating AI portraits of Black women impacted you and your work?
I'm very interested in algorithms, especially the more commercial generic ones that we encounter, especially that artists like to employ to create art. And so for the series you're referring to, I was very interested particularly in one algorithm, how it represented Black hair. And so through multiple generations of that algorithm, I'm investigating how the developers have like worked and paid attention to Black hair on Black women as it's visualized through braids. So whether it's an afro, whether it's a twist, how does it make sense of these like different words and the ways that we phrase it? Yeah.
Wow, Monet. I mean, I just love like you're looking at so many different things. It's sort of like your work is like it's multidisciplinary, but it's also sort of like this mosaic of like, you know, you're looking at things from a different angles. And I just think that's so interesting. What advice do you have for women artists?
Jacqueline, I don't know if I'm in the position to give advice.
Well, yes, you are. Here you are. You're getting ready to finish your doctorate. You're soon to be Dr. Atairu. And, you know, think about like a young woman or a young girl who is interested in being an artist, you know, or who is interested in art. Like, what advice would you have for young women considering pursuing a career in the arts or studies in the arts?
I mean, I'm a Black, I identify as a Black artist. And so I think for me, we talked about my identity and how I developed my identity. And it was having this validation and community of people who understood my work from a certain perspective, even if they didn't quite get the conceptual underpinnings. And I think having a community of support or just a community of like-minded individuals, it's very important. Even if you don't, as an artist, get that validation from institutions, because that's just as important, having the shows and exhibitions, but the community is most important.
And that community can collaborate and create their own shows. And,
exactly.
And I mean, that's what's been going on in at least American, Black American art history. So many women have picked up the torch and just moved forward. So absolutely. I love that you said you start your creativity process starts with a question. And I'm just curious, do you have an idea where that method comes from? How did you develop that strategy?
Sadia Hartman, critical fabulation, right? And Sadia talks about what happens when you express wishes and doubts, when your process is more about like doubting this truth, like pushing at the limits, at the edges of the archive, right? Because archives always have this notion that they're telling us the truth about history. And that's all we can know, right? There's nothing outside the archive to counter the archive. So as Black folks, the way we counter these truths that we're offered every day is by expressing wishes and doubts. And for me, it comes with this what if questions, right? What could have happened? What could have been said? What could have done? What if I chose to do this as opposed to that? And that's where it all starts for me.
You were talking about going to art school when you were in Nigeria, and I've never been to Nigeria. So I'm just curious if you could elaborate on what that, you know, how that process works. And is it something that is common for girls to do, for young women to do? Just if you could elaborate on that.
At the time, I think now it's much more common. At the time, it wasn't as common as, say, you know, computer engineering or whatever exists in the sciences. And I was privileged, I have to say. I have four siblings before me. So they all carried on the burden of being, you know, the child who studied medicine or nursing and engineering. And they satisfied my parents in that way. So I'm privileged that my siblings did the work for me so that I can make the choice to be an artist. Otherwise, you know, for other kids of my age who didn't have siblings, they had to choose the path of the lawyer or the doctor. That's, you know, a thing in Nigeria. I don't know if it is in the US. So I know that initially my dad was like, when I got my admission to university, my dad was like, are you sure you don't want to be a computer engineer? You like computers? He was trying to persuade me to change my major. And I was like, this is what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
And what's something that you're reading right now?
What I'm reading? I'm reading a lot of different books. I am reading Wayward Lives by Sadia for the third time because I love Sadia Hartman's work. I'm also reading, I just bought the book on something about creativity by bell hooks, because I've been reading that one article, but I know it's from a whole book. So mm-hmm. I just bought it and Amazon hasn't delivered it. So that's mm-hmm. something I know I will be reading.
Oh gosh, I love bell hooks. I mean, Cynthia Hartman and bell hooks. I mean, we are so blessed to have them as teachers.
Yeah.
So is there anything that you want to add or address that you feel might be interesting for, particularly for women artists around the world to hear?
Exactly. You keep asking me for advice.
Well, you're amazing. You're an award-winning artist.
Oh my God.
And so you have, you know, you're charting a path. And so we're trying to learn, you know,
yeah,
along the way, some things that Mine has
learned.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing I would say I have learned this year, and this year has been just 4 months, is like knowing when to say no. There was a time I would say yes to everything that was thrown my way in terms of like an artist, right? And the invitations I get, because I would assume those opportunities were too great to let go. But then at the end, you're just like traumatized. And also being very much aware of when you're the diversity count in the group. Mm-hmm, if mm-hmm. it's an exhibition, mm-hmm. you probably want to ask if there are other artists, not just maybe Black artists is maybe mm-hmm. too much of an ask, but if there are other artists of color in the group.
Right.
Because right. you don't want your art to be that one lone work. It right. needs company.
Yes, yes.
It needs company. So I think it's important to know where to draw the line and say no and say yes, and to avoid experiences that could potentially be traumatic for you. Because sometimes when it happens, I just pull away from the whole process and it makes it difficult for you to continue pursuing your practice.
Well, I'm all for that. No more. Mary J. Blige said no more peace. Drama. I say no more trauma too.
Protect your peace
yes,
at all costs.
We've been through enough. Yeah. Yeah.
And when those offers, typically when they come, you can sniff it from a distance.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what could potentially come from that. So you want to avoid it as much as possible.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today on Beyond Beauty, the podcast.
And thank you, Jacqueline.
I'm so excited to see all that you're going to be doing and following you. Your journey, because I mean, just in the few years that I've gotten to know you, I mean, I can't even keep up. Like, it's just so much going on. I'm so excited. It's just very, you know, I'm very proud of you. So you keep shining, and we will be staying tuned.
Thank you, Jacqueline, for all you do for Black women and Black artists. You're putting us in Columbia's archive, and that is a great thing. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to Beyond Beauty. I hope you found today's conversation with Mine Atairu as inspiring as I did. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast for more enriching discussions with extraordinary women artists and scholars who are shaping the cultural landscape. Thank you for joining us on this enlightening expedition through the world of women artists from the Global South and its diasporas. We hope you've been inspired by the stories shared and perspectives explored. Remember, beauty knows no bounds and creativity thrives in every corner of the globe. Keep seeking out the voices that challenge, uplift, and redefine our understanding of art and culture. Until next time, stay curious, stay open-minded, and continue to explore the beauty that lies beyond beauty.